Chapter 23. When Pitt's father opened the door to his colonial home on Massachusetts Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, he wore a faded pair of khaki pants and a well-snagged pullover sweater. The Socrates of the Senate was noted for his expensive and fashionable suits, always embellished with a California golden poppy in the lapel. But out of the public eye, he dressed like a rancher camped out on the range.
"Dirk," he said with pleasure, giving his son a warm bear hug. "I see you too infrequently these days."
Pitt put his arm around the senator's shoulder, and they walked side by side into a paneled den with filled bookshelves stretching from floor to ceiling. A fire flickered from an ornate mantel carved from teak. The senator motioned his son to a chair and walked behind a wet bar. "Bombay gin martini with a twist, isn't it?" "A bit cool for gin. How about a Jack Daniel's straight up?" "Every man to his own poison. How's Mom?"
"She's at some highfalutin spa, a fat farm in California, on her annual crusade to lose weight. She'll be back day after tomorrow, 2 pounds heavier.
She never gives up.
It keeps her happy."
The senator passed Pitt a bourbon and then poured himself a port. He raised the glass. "Here's to a fruitful trip to Colorado." Pitt didn't drink. "Whose bright idea was it to send me skiing?"
"Mine."
Pitt calmly took a swallow of Jack Daniels and gave his father a hard stare. "What is your involvement with the Alexandria Library artifacts?"
"Very heavy, if they truly exist."
"Are you speaking as a private citizen or a bureaucrat?"
"A patriot."
"All right," Pitt said with a deep sigh. "Fill me in. Why are classical art and literary works and the coffin of Alexander so vital to United States interests?"
"None of the above," said the senator. "The prime meat of the inventory is maps showing geological resources of the ancient world. The lost gold mines of the pharaohs, the forgotten emerald mines of Cleopatra, the fabled but mystic land of Punt that was famous for its riches of silver, antimony, and unusual greenish gold. Locations known 2,000 and 3,000 years ago but buried in the oblivion of time. There was also the fabulous land of Ophir and its recorded wealth of precious minerals. Its location still remains a tantalizing mystery. The mines of King Solomon, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, and Sheba, the Queen of Saba, whose fabled land today is only a biblical memory. The legendary wealth of the ages still lies hidden under the sands of the Middle East."
"So it's found. So what? How can precious mineral deposits belonging to other countries concern our government?"
"As bargaining chips," answered the senator. "If we are able to point the way, negotiations can be opened for joint ventures in the exploitation. We can also make points with national leaders and spread a little badly needed goodwill."
Pitt shook his head and considered. "News to me, Congress has turned to prospecting for good foreign relations. Must be more to this than meets the eye."
The senator nodded, marveling at his son's insight. "There is. Are you familiar with the term stratigraphic trap?"
"I should be," Pitt smiled. "I found one in the Labrador Sea off Quebec Province a few years ago."
"Yes, the Doodlebug Project, I remember. A stratigraphic trap is one of the toughest oil deposits to discover. Normal seismic exploration won't detect it. Yet they often prove out to have incredibly high yields."
"Which leads us to bitumen, a hydrocarbon like tar or asphalt that was used in Mesopotamia as long as 5,000 years ago for waterproofing buildings, canals, clay drainage pipes, and caulking boats. Other uses included roads, treatment of wounds, and adhesives. Much later, the Greeks mentioned springs along the North African coast that bubble with oil. The Romans recorded a site in the Sinai they called Petrol Mountain, and the Bible tells of God ordering Jacob to suck oil out of flint-like rock, and describes the Vale of Siddim being full of slime pits, which can be interpreted as tar pits."
"None of these areas has been relocated or drilled?" Pitt asked.
"There has been drilling, yes, but no significant strikes to date. Geologists claim there's a 90% probability of finding 500 million barrels of crude petroleum under Israel alone. Unfortunately, the ancient sites have been lost and covered over through the centuries due to land upheavals and earthquakes."
"Then the main goal is to find a massive oil bonanza in Israel."
"You have to admit it would solve a multitude of problems."
"Yes, I guess it would."
The senator and Pitt sat in silence for the next minute, staring into the fire. If Yeager and his computer banks didn't pick up a lead, the chances were at best hopeless.
Pitt was suddenly angered that the power brokers in the White House and Congress were more interested in oil and gold than in the art and literature that could fill in the missing gaps of history. It was, he thought, a sad commentary on the affairs of state. The silence was broken by the ring of the telephone. The senator walked over to a desk and picked up the receiver. He said nothing, merely listened for a moment. Then he hung up. "I doubt if I'll find the lost library in Colorado," Pitt said dryly. "Everyone concerned would be surprised if you did," the senator came back. "My staff has arranged a briefing for you by the leading authority on the subject. Dr. Bertram Rothberg, a professor of classical history at the University of Colorado, has made the study of the Alexandria Library his life's work. He'll fill you in on background data that could help your search." "Why do I have to go to him? Seems to me it would be more practical to bring him to Washington." "You met with Admiral Sandecker?" "Yes." "Then you know it's vital to distance yourself and Al Giardino from the discovery of the Soviet submarine. That phone call a minute ago was from an FBI agent who was tailing a KGB agent who was tailing you." "Nice to know I'm popular." "You're to make no move that would cause suspicion." Pitt nodded approvingly. "Fine and dandy, but suppose the Russians get wise to the mission. They have as much to gain by laying their hands on the library data as we do." "The possibility exists, but is extremely remote," the senator said guardedly. "We've taken every precaution to keep the wax tablets secret." "Next question." "Shoot." "I'm under surveillance," said Pitt. "What's to stop the KGB from following me to Dr. Rothberg's doorstep?" "Nothing," the senator answered. "We have every intention of sitting on the sidelines and cheering them on." "So we put on a show of status quo." "Exactly." "Why me?" "Because of your L-29 cord."
"My cord?"
"The classic car you had restored in Denver. The man you hired called here last week and said to tell you the job is finished and she looks beautiful." "So I traveled to Colorado under a spotlight to pick up my collector car, get in a little ski time on the slopes, and party with Dr. Sharp." "Exactly," the senator repeated. "You're to check into the Hotel Breckenridge. A message will be waiting explaining where and when you'll make contact with Dr. Rothberg."
"Remind me never to trade horses with you."
The senator laughed. "You've been involved in some pretty devious schemes yourself." Pitt finished the bourbon, stood, and placed his glass on the mantel. "Mind if I borrow the family lodge?"
"I'd prefer you stay away from it."
"But my boots and skis are stored in the garage."
"You can rent your equipment."
"That's ridiculous."
"Not so ridiculous," the senator said in an even voice, "when you consider that the instant you open the front door, you'll be shot."
"You sure you want to get out here, buddy?" the cab driver inquired as he stopped beside what looked like an abandoned hangar on one corner of Washington's International Airport.
"This is the place," replied Pitt.
The driver glanced warily around at the deserted, unlit area. This had all the earmarks of a mugging, he thought. He reached under the front seat for a length of pipe he hid for such an occasion. He kept an apprehensive eye on the rearview mirror as Pitt pulled a wallet from his inside coat pocket. The driver relaxed slightly. His fare wasn't acting like a mugger.
"What do I owe you?"
"I got $8.60 on the meter," the driver replied.
Pitt paid the fare plus tip and exited the cab, waiting for the driver to open the trunk and remove the luggage.
"Hell of a place for a drop," the driver muttered.
"Someone is meeting me."
Pitt stood and watched the cab's taillights dim in the distance before he turned off the hangar's alarm system with a pocket transmitter and entered through a side door. He pressed a code on the transmitter, and the interior became bathed in bright fluorescent light. The hangar was Pitt's home. The main floor was lined with a glittering collection of classic and milestone automobiles. There were also an old Pullman railroad car and a Ford tri-motor airplane. The most bizarre oddity was a cast-iron bathtub with an outboard motor attached to it. He walked toward his living quarters, which stretched across an upper level against the far wall. Reached by an ornate iron spiral staircase, the door at the top opened onto a living room flanked by a large bedroom and a study on one side, and a dining area and kitchen on the other. He unpacked and entered a shower stall, turning up the hot water and aiming the nozzle against a tiled wall. He lay on his back with his feet stretched upward, just below the faucets, so he could control the spray temperature with his toes.
Then he promptly dozed off. 45 minutes later, Pitt slipped on a robe and turned on the TV set. He was about to reheat a pot of Texas chili when the buzzer on the intercom sounded. He pressed the door speaker button, half expecting Al Giordino to answer.
"Yes?"
"Greenland Catering," a feminine voice answered. He laughed and pressed a switch that unlocked the side door. He stepped onto the balcony and stared down. Lily walked in carrying a large picnic basket. She stopped and gazed in astonishment for several moments, her eyes dazzled by the light reflecting off the sea of chrome and highly polished lacquer paint. "Admiral Sandecker tried to describe your place to me," she said admiringly, "but he didn't do it justice." Pitt came down the stairs to meet her. He took the picnic basket and nearly dropped it. "This thing weighs a ton. What's in it?"
"Our late dinner. I stopped off at a delicatessen and picked up a few goodies."
"Smells like a tasty menu."
"We begin with smoked salmon, followed by wild mushroom soup, spinach salad with pheasant and walnuts, linguine in oyster sauce and white wine, all washed down with a bottle of Principes Agave. For dessert, we have coffee chocolate trifle."
Pitt looked down at Lily and smiled in genuine admiration. Her face was alive and her eyes sparkling. There was a vibrancy he had not noticed before. Her hair was brushed long and straight. She wore a tight-fitting tank dress with a revealing back and black sequins that flashed as she walked. Free of the heavy coat she had worn since Greenland, her breasts loomed larger and her hips more slender than he had pictured them in his imagination. Her legs were long and angled provocatively, and she moved with a sensual vivacity. After they entered his living room, Pitt dropped the food basket in a chair and reached out and took her hand.
"We can eat later," he said softly.
In automatic shyness, she dropped her gaze downward. Then slowly, as if drawn by an irresistible force, her eyes slowly rose to meet his. Pitt's green eyes were so piercing that her legs grew weak and her hands trembled. She began to flush. This was stupid, Lily thought. She had calmly planned the seduction, down to the right wine, the dress and the alluring black lace bra and panties beneath. And now she was swept by confusion and doubt. She didn't dream things would move so quickly. Without a word, Pitt peeled the straps from Lily's shoulders, allowing the sequined dress to fall in a pool of shimmering light around her high heels. He slipped his hand around her bare waist and under her knees, lifting her body in one flowing motion. As he carried her into the bedroom, she buried her face against his chest.
"I feel like a brazen harlot," she whispered.
Pitt tenderly laid her on the bed and looked down. The sight of her body made the fire burn within him. "Better," he said in a husky voice, "that you act like one."